Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Gentleman's Talk. I've got an interesting subject coming up. I've been deep in thought for this for a little while. It's going to be a difficult one, but I think for me personally, I'm in a strong place at the moment, strong enough to try and articulate the story correctly, if you like. And when I give you the subject, you'll understand a bit more. But I just want to caveat that with, I want everyone to know that the reason I'm doing a series, and it's going to be a series, it's going to be a three-part series, and the reason I'm doing this is because I want people to understand, not from a selfish point of view and look at me in the sense of saying, look how far I've come, look at me, rah, 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 but it's more, I want people to be able to look at me and say, if he can do it, I can do it. It's kind of like, I want people to understand where I've come from, where I got to, and really give you a bit of a story and a bit of some details on my darkest hour. Now, there'll be a lot of people that don't want to listen to this, I must also underpin that with the fact that this is a trigger situation. So if you do listen to this, just be cautious that you have to get through the whole of the series to understand it, because it's going to be quite lengthy, quite detailed. And the reason I'm doing this is for educational purposes. I want people to understand that what goes through a typical man's mind. I want people to understand that the details of why we don't get help, or certainly my reasons why I don't get help. I'd like to give you where I've been and a detailed account of that, because I want you to understand that men can be in these horrible places. But more importantly, the most important part of this, and this is what I must emphasize, is the fact that I'm telling you this is proof that the well-being and the mental health and the the work-life balance, everything, all these good things that I talk about and I've spoke about over 118 episodes, all of this is, it's just proof in the pudding. And we can sit there and you can listen to me and you can say, oh yeah, I've tried that. He goes on about this and this and this. And it's very easy to say that. And you all probably, if you've got to 117 and you're listening at this point, you'll know a lot about me. And what spurred this on really was, I did a couple of episodes ago, I spoke to, about my daughter and how she said to me she wished that she understands that I was angry when I had my mental health conditions and when I was in the depths of my depression. She understood the anger, because anger is a very easily understandable emotion. It's a very disruptive emotion. And she understood that, but she didn't understand the mental health. And if you recall in the previous podcast, that was quite a big part for me. Sorry, got tongue-tied there. And it sort of spurred me on, because when I spoke to my friend about this, and I had a conversation with my good friend Billy, and we were chatting, and I said to him about this, and he went, well, just tell your daughter to listen to the first three episodes of your podcast. You will find out exactly who I am and where I've come from and what I've been through. And that's the purpose of this. And throughout some of the series, I have spoke about this as a synopsis on my life, as well as, you know, trying to help people and give people motivation. I'd like to give people hope. I'm sat in my cabin in the middle of my garden, nowhere special. I'm nothing special myself. But when you listen to these, it's very easy to get to a point and go, well, he keeps saying this, he keeps saying that, he keeps talking about this and that, and it all revolves around meditation, mindfulness, music, reflection, all the good stuff, doesn't it? But I don't think I've ever really given details of where I've been. I've spoken about it, but I want to give a little account of me, I mean, who I am, where I've come from, just so you can see that I'm just an average Joe, but I've suffered horrendously but I've also built a structure and a platform and a foundation to be a better person, to try every single day to be a better person. So, you know, as you all know, it's my, you know, my name's James Dean Littlejohn, and you know, I'm an ex-army son, so I've moved around a lot. So I have experienced, I'll give you a brief bit, you know, part of it, but I have experienced extreme elements of bullying when I was younger. Some horrendous bullying, actually, which was probably because I was quite an outgoing person. I've always been the centre of attention, and as much as what I joke about it, I know I am. I like being the centre of attention. But that bites you in the arse sometimes, you know? So it's because I've always been there. I've always been the focus of everybody. I did have an unusual hairstyle at school, which is never really a good thing. And you know, my name was James Dean Littlejohn. Now, it doesn't have the same weight or gravitas as it does when you're an elder or an older person. Sorry, elder, like I'm some sort of fucking tribe guru there. An older person. When I say my name's James Dean Littlejohn now, it's fucking amazing. Everyone's like, James Dean. As in, like, you know, Rebel, and I was like, yeah, you know. And Little John, as in what? As in, like, Robin Hood. And you're like, yeah, you know. And it's fucking amazing. When you were younger, you got horrendously bullied. And the reason I know about that now is because I see my children and I've seen the bullying that has been focused around them. So it never stops. It doesn't matter who you are. I just happened to be the person that everyone wanted to pick on because I had glaringly obvious, you know, pick on points, if you like. You know, I wasn't a local because I'd moved around a lot, so I didn't grow up in the area, so I didn't have the groups. I came in, you know, the sort of late part of you know, secondary school, so I'd lost all the cliques. And then obviously you become a forefocus of a bit of bullying. So, but that wasn't, you know, me. That did make me the person I am. It's made me quite resilient, but at the same time, I've just, you know, I'm no different. I didn't go to a special school. I didn't have any special treatment. I was just an average person. And I just went through life. I did mechanics for 3 years, become fully qualified, and then didn't like it. So, you know, I moved into the Royal Air Force and then carried on my career till it ended and then stayed in that further on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I won't bore you about my roles. So just an average person, really. And like I said, for me, the depression aspect, when it kicked in, and then obviously, you know, I had those three horrendous car crashes, and then we sort of fast forward into the depression. Now, as you can see from all of that rhetoric there, you know, it's a quick overview of me, just a normal average Joe that I've suffered a little bit of abnormality in the terms of bullying at school. But you know, you build up resilience to that. It's just one of those things you just have to live and learn with. It's absolutely, they've got a better grip on it now. I don't think they've got the best grip they can have on it. I certainly think there's massive amounts of improvements, but I do know that dealing with children is a delicate area, so you have to be careful on what restrictions you can apply, etc., etc. So it's, you know, it's never going to go away. You just have to try and mitigate it as much as you can by providing as much as you can for your children to make it so they're not that centre of attention, if you like, in a negative format anyway. So yeah, just apart from that, just a normal average life, I suppose. You know, I have travelled a little bit, but I've always, like I said, I've always been that sort of centre of attention. And that's really the focus point of this, of where I fall into. So when I developed my depression and then finally, after many years, got diagnosed with it by a professional, and by that point, I was in the depths. I was in the darkest point, but I was still quite strong because I didn't formally understand it. And when I sort of think about the depression, I always think, and I remember Category telling a few people when I said, you know, I don't feel right, I feel funny. I've done how to describe it, I just didn't feel right. Everyone was like, oh, don't be silly, mate, you're having a bad day, you're just a bit tired. Because I was always the forefront of attention, I was always, I always liked to be the center of attention. People really inherently didn't believe that I had depression, and that's the be all and end all of it. And I think that's because we're talking years back now when I was first diagnosed with it. No one really believed it. No one would believe it. They just, when you couple the fact that, you know, I was quite an aggressive person. I was quite angry all the time when I was younger. I had a lot of testosterone. I also found out, obviously, being diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, that if I'd have been diagnosed with a child, I probably would have had a lot of that under control, because all of the traits through ADHD were massively, massively apparent when I was younger, when you reflect back on my age. But because of all of those and not going diagnosed in any way, shape or form, it was just my personality. My personality was, it's just James. He's a bit feisty, or he's a bit loud, he's a bit brash. I remember going to a wedding reception on the previous Friday just gone by. And I walked in and I was excited. I was seeing people and I was being around people. However, you know, my mum at the time told me 5 times that night to calm down and keep quiet, you know, keep the noise down. She's being really loud. I didn't think I was. And it made me laugh when I thought about it, because I was like, well, this is who I've always been. You can't tell me to be quiet. I'm 41. It's really hard to tell me to be quiet when I'm still doing it at 41, what I've been doing for the last 41 years. It, even now, there's still people that think I'm really loud and brash, you know, so it's always been my personality, it's always been, and that's what, that is the problem, and that's where the problem lies, and I think that problem lies with a lot of other people, and that's when, if you're that forefront of attention, the reason I'm casting my mind on this and sticking to this point is because maybe you're that person, you see, maybe it's not seen as out of character when you lash out, when you're aggressive or you're loud, because maybe you're that loud person, maybe you're that brash person, maybe you're the guy that always wants, you know, is always the forefront of attention. I certainly am. I fucking love it, you know. My boss keeps saying to me, you need to be more quiet. I'm like, fuck off, I'm not changing who I am. I don't care what anyone says. The day you try to change me is the day that I discard you. Fucking done. I've learned that now. I'm not gonna change. It's who I am. It's got me fucking 41 years in fucking life, and I've been pretty successful. So, you know, for me, I'm in the sense I'm still alive. But do you know what I mean? I've done quite a bit, and I think it's got me to where I am. But maybe you're that person, you see. And it's weird, because what depression does is it does a mixture of things, you see. It draws you in. It makes you quiet. It makes you, avoid things, avoid people. Now, if you're an introvert, say, for instance, that may already be your personality, so no one's going to notice the difference. The only time you would notice a difference is if you were an introvert and then you started lashing out more. But that could be, that would be the only time that would be noticed, but that just could be something that you may do or any. So it's very difficult to understand mental health. If you're that loud, brash person, and that's what I remember saying to my mum and my dad when I sat them down and said to them about what I was, you know, what happened to me and what I'd been diagnosed with, and tried to explain the purposes of why I've been like I have been for like 4 or 5 years, they're just like, we don't understand it. We just saw it as you were just being an obnoxious, rebellious person, but nothing out of character. So it was kind of this act of me, you know, this part of me acting out and, you know, walking away from people and shutting people out and, you know, getting drunk and being loud and brash would seem that's my personality. So it's kind of like, as you get older, obviously certain aspects tail off. You don't get to get as, I mean, I'm nowhere as aggressive as I probably used to be. I'm just, I like to relax a little bit. So there'll be people laughing, by the way, at that, but that comment. So, you know, that you may be that person that people don't notice that difference. Maybe you're that person and you don't notice the difference. I certainly didn't for years. I just thought it was me. I genuinely, even after speaking to psychiatrists, speaking to therapists, speaking to my doctor, speaking to the hospital, even speaking to those people, all of them never really picked up. It's just the norm, because I was a very polite person, you know, when I was talking to them. They never saw it as, Well, we just can't see that in you, because that's the Jekyll and Hyde in me. That's the part where I can be the politest person in the world, and you know, you pissed me off, or the flick of a switch, I can discard you. But even the doctors didn't pick it up. They just sort of said for years, no, well, we'll put you on these antidepressants. That must be what it is, which was kind of the only thing they can really do. You go to therapy, you listen, but nothing changes. It was only when I started this journey 8 months ago, 10 months ago, Christ alive, that's flown by, 10 months ago, where I actually was, I can actually feel a difference. Yes, I do have good days and I have bad days. I say this all the way through my podcasts. But I do feel that it's worth it. And that's why I want you to listen and the build up there to understand where I've come from. And when I say the darkest hour, my darkest hour, I'm going to talk very much in detail of what it's like and what your mindset goes through when you no longer want to be with us, when you think that suicide is your last and only hope to get away from the abuse that is in your mind, the devastating words that pop up into your head. And for me, I can remember it like it was yesterday. You never forget an incident like that in your life. It is a genuine scar. And it's a battle scar. And we all like, as men, we like scars. So it's one of those things. And that's why I refer to it as a scar. Because men used to, you had just scars. You used to be big and hard when you were, well, you know, when I was growing up anyway. Not so much now. Everyone wants perfect skin. But if you had marks and scars and cuts, and it was the sign that you were a man. So, you know, I've got scars on my legs where I come off of a motorbike, where I was sat on the front handlebars of a motorbike doing about 60 miles an hour along a gravel path with my mate. I was on the handlebars riding bars. He was, my mate was riding the bike. He was actually, you know, throttle control. And then my other mate, Luke, was on the fucking mud guard. So we had knobblies on gravel, so knobblies, you know, scrambler tires, and I was going to him fucking faster and faster. And then Luke in the back decided, you know, he wanted to fucking give him a dead arm. So he gave him a dead arm because he said he was going too fast. I'm screaming, go faster. Fucking Chris White, my mate Whitey, was fucking going, and literally, because he punched him so hard, Luke fucking grabbed his sleeve down, pulled his hand off the throttle to get him off, and we slid down. So we hit the side of the thing. We slid through, and then I went through a barbed wire fence. Now, I managed to bash my hand, I've got quite big hands, right in front of my face, which pushed the first layer of barbed wire up. And then the second barbed wire caught my jeans. I had some thick jeans on, luckily, and then ripped them through my scars on my legs. So I had like 3 or 4 scars on my legs. But my hand, the top of my hand, was all ripped open. It was quite horrendous. I'm telling you about a story because it's a proof of why we like scars. And, you know, we walked home and it's like gravel in all my hands. And I just went, oh, fuck it, we better go. Do you know what I mean? So we went to see Chris White's mum. So we pushed the bike. We were just sat there with my hand pissing out. And we were just like, I said, it would be all right, you know, fucking be fine. We'll walk back. It was only a mile back. So I'm walking back, my hand wrapped up in my T-shirt. And we walk in and I saw Chris White's mum, a lovely, lovely lady, you know, may she rest in peace. She passed away a number of years ago through cancer, unfortunately. So there was a dark time for me and my friends. And anyway, yeah, we digress. But she was an amazing woman. And I remember walking in and she was a nurse. So she said, well, let's have a look then, James, come on. And she took the hand off and she went white because she was like, I don't know what the fuck you've done. I did not expect this. And then she pulled herself together and then she started rinsing it under the sink and getting all this fucking, getting all the gravel out and stuff and bandaged it up. And then went to see the doctors and they just wrapped up. Nowadays, they would have stitched you and made it look nice. I've got a nice battle scar right across my hand. But that's why we like scars. You know, so I reference it as a scar, this certain incident. And so you never forget it. You don't, and that's why you won't forget that. And it was just a normal day. It was just a day in work. It was actually a Wednesday night. I was tired. I was exhausted. I'd been living away. I didn't really sort of kind of. It was I felt like the world was kind of on top of me, but wasn't on top of me. And it was like the morning, and I'd already kind of pre-planned, really, because I don't think you pre-plan it, but you kind of go through the night when you're going to sleep, you kind of have all these demon thoughts going through your head, and it's like, I don't want to be here, I can't suffer this anymore. What's the fucking purpose? Why should I be here? I don't understand why I be here. Every day's negative. I don't understand what my purpose is. How do I get this life that I look at all the time around me on Facebook and social media? How do I get that life? You know, what do I have to do to succeed? How do I get money? Oh, fuck, she doesn't love me. Or do you know what I mean? Christ, my kids are, you know, being raised, and what troubles am I have there? So you have all these things running through your head, but a lot of these things are normally put to side. You know, normally you just go, okay, well, of course my girls will be fucking fine. What are you on about? You know, when you're in a stronger situation. And then you turn around and you would think about other things, and you're like, what's my purpose? My purpose is to enjoy my life, mate. You know, I'm going to have a fucking good time. Not here for a long time, I'm here for a good time. And it's easy, very easy to say that when you're mentally focused or you're in a better place. I certainly didn't say that night, I can assure you. So those things are running through your head. So you have a really awful night's sleep. So you wake up the next day and then you get fucking tired. And the way it started for me was, I was like, right, I'm really fucking tired now. So I went downtown in the morning and I got some Cocodamols because I was like, I've got a banging headache. My back was hurting. I was miserable as fucking sin. And I thought, you know what? My job's piece of piss. I can function if I fucking need to. And if not, I'll just tell, because, you know, I was very fortunate. I worked with my best friend. So if I ever felt shit, I could just say to him, you know, dude, can you cover for me or whatever? You know, you were always looked after. And I remember going down, and it was a specific day. And I went down and picked up some Cocodamol, got 32. There was three chemists, and I went, oh, when I'm down here, because at the time I was taking Cocodamols to get rid of the pain and try and help me sleep. So I was naturally taking them. So I was naturally taking 6 to 8 a day at some points to get rid of the fucking migraines I was getting from the bad back, which was like, I thought was to do with having a bad back. It's not. It's to do with the fact that I'm a very stressed person. And that's why I still got it now, even though all my doctor's shit says I'm fucking fine. But they're like, no, you've just got massive amounts of tension. So I went down, got a couple of boxes. And then when I came back, I asked a colleague to go down and said, oh, mate, I ain't got a chance to go out. Can you go and get me another couple? Can you get me a box of Cocodamol? So I'd had about 90 now. It would have been more than that because it was 32. So it was 96 I had. So that was it, really. That was the start. And I took a couple in the morning, and I took a couple of hours later, and I started to get drowsy. You know, you're starting to get think, I just want to go to sleep now. But it's almost like, for me, it was the start of that euphoria, in the sense I'd taken probably about 12, and I was like, okay, I need to go to bed because I'm fucking drowsy now, you know, and this isn't good. I've got to drive and all this sort of stuff. So I didn't actually. I got a friend to drop me off. And when I got dropped off, because I was like, I just can't drive. Can you pick me up in the morning, sort of thing? But at the same time, it was a sense of relief. It was a sense of I didn't care, because I was so drowsy, I didn't really care. And because I was living away, I remember I went up into my annex, and it was a very cold, dark place. It was, I mean, in terms of a family home, you know, I stayed in the annex of this quite wealthy couple, absolutely amazing couple, they really were, but they had this, it was just them, there was a couple and their one son, and they had this like 8-bedroom mansion with tennis court and fucking, and it had an annex, it had like a big double garage, and above the double garage had a single room with all the amenities, which was put in by the previous owner to get money to rent out for the locals. And that paid for the mortgage, or the part percentage of the mortgage, which gave you the ability to afford to live in a nice country house, because it was stunning. There was three houses in this little area. But so from a family perspective, it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I used to love waking up and looking at the sun over miles and miles of fields. But it was all, for me, it was all fake, because I was just renting a place. It wasn't with my family. And I remember going back this specific evening, and I was very drowsy. I didn't even manage to have a shower. And I sat on the bed and I said, oh, do you know what? If I take another couple more, then that'll proper fucking pass me out. And then, because I felt so fucking relaxed. I was like, I was kind of in the mode of fighting it then. I was kind of going, oh no, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go to sleep just yet. But then I was thinking about the negatives, and I was thinking about how horrible things were, and how I started playing myself down. I started saying I was useless. I was a fucking nasty person. I was horrible. I didn't know what the fuck I wanted in life. I was pathetic. I was going through all of these negative connotations towards myself. And you build yourself into a psyche. You build yourself into an area where you don't want to be. You kind of, it's really hard to explain, but when I say it's the darkest hour, it was that last hour, and it was between 9 and 10. And I was just sat there, there was nothing on TV, staring at the screen, and I just remember wanting to go for a walk, because it was one of those evenings, it was a nice evening, it was pleasant to go around, and I wanted to just sit there and stare at the sky. It was a clear sky. And I remember, but consciously, I took my tablets with me, and I don't know why. I haven't got a clue why. And I remember going up to the top of this hill, and I sat down, and I just sat there, and I had nothing around me. I had no one. I felt the loneliest I've ever felt in my life. But at the same time, when you looked on the outside inwards, and this is the point I always talk about, is I was the happy-go-lucky guy. I always put the brave face on when I was at home. I was always the happy, brave face at work. I would laugh and joke and do stupid things, and I would, you know, make it seem like everything was okay. But I did it so professionally that I could have done it as a career. But it was when you went home and you were led there and you were lonely and you sit there contemplating, why am I so lonely when I've got everything around me? I'd made the wrong decisions. I'd made the wrong calls. I didn't know how to get out the rut, because the rut was I was tied into a job that I was good at, but there was nowhere to work for. So, but I didn't know how to get out the hole. I was already in depression. So I'd already got to this point. You've got to remember, this isn't an afterthought. This is after months and months of sadness. This is just the accumulation of one night. This is just where I've reached the end. For months and months, I was going home, going to my room and being lonely with nothing, just someone else's room, someone else's bed, someone else's duvet, someone else's apartment, you know, annex. It wasn't mine. It was nothing to do with me. And you lived alone for Sunday to Thursday every single week. And that takes its toll on you. You become very lonely. Those little negative thoughts that start chipping away, they become so ingrained that they become natural to say. And you naturally look at life in a difficult way. When you say things like, that's really shit, my job's really shit, you may think that as a passing thought, but then the more and more you reinforce it, the more and more it embeds into your brain. And that's just one thing then that's now a naturally occurring negative thought every single day. When you start to hate someone, you might say, oh god, that person, I just dislike him a little bit, he's a bit annoying. Oh no, he's really starting to fuck me off now. Actually, yeah, you're really pissing me off now. And then again, the more you say it, the more you think it, the more that you embed that thought about that person in your brain. And it's really hard to get out of that. And that's nothing. That's indicative of life. And that's what we do. The depression starts with the poor chemical imbalance. You're feeding your brain more negativity than positivity. And then it all builds up, and you constantly do this. And then every time you walk into work, or you go into home life, or you go to somewhere, you will naturally look at that person without even thinking about it. You'll subconsciously say, I don't like him. You might not even remember why, but you're subconsciously saying, I don't like him, or I don't like this job. And you subconsciously say it. I'm saying enough now, so you should get used to it. But you're saying, I don't like this job. And it's reinforced. And you say it enough, it becomes natural. if I don't or don't like this, I don't like doing this task, the more you say it, the more that it becomes natural that you don't like that task. And that is what happens in life. That's what happens in your depression stage, or certainly my experience of it is. You just start building negativity and it just becomes the norm. And then what happens is you don't release serotonin. You just constantly surrounded by negativity. The serotonin's gone. You're not getting excitement out of life anymore. So you're negative all the time. You're depressed. You're sad. You're stressed. You're tense. And then all the accumulation of weeks and weeks and months of that, and not dealing with it and don't know how to deal with it because I never spoke to anyone. I never dealt with it. And then literally sat on the top of this hill with tablets. And then taking those tablets and then just taking one and one more, going, you almost to the point where you do it subconsciously. It's great. You don't even think about it. You don't even acknowledge that you're putting these in your mouth. You just swallow them. You just, and then you think, okay, well, that's more than enough. And then you just sit there and you just get drowsy. My fortunate thing was, is I obviously was crying for help, but didn't know who I was crying for. So I remember drinking alcohol, which made me throw up. And that was my first encounter of my darkest hour. The build-up to that was horrendous. The build-up was awful. I didn't speak out. I didn't talk to anyone. I didn't ask for advice. I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know how to turn to. I still had to function. I was still a functioning father, husband, boss, you name it. I still had to function daily. I still had to be all of those personalities. And then I remember going into work the very next day, tired because of the tablets that were in me. And I never said a word. And I remember sitting there going, I've got a massive migraine. It wasn't. It was the fact that I'd had so much chemicals in me. And I remember going into my friend and saying, who happened to work with me, I said, dude, I've got a really bad migraine. I'm going to have to go and sit in the office. And that was the day after. And I worked with my best friend, the one I'm friends with for 29 years now. And I never told him. And it wasn't because we hadn't built up a relationship enough to talk about. It's because I didn't open up. Because now I'm an open person. Absolutely. We talk all the time about these. We talk more in depth about our problems than ever. And I do that with all of my friends because I think it's really important. But that's how easy depression can take a grip of you. Every day. You can go along and you can just be the normal person. You can just pretend to everybody that you're okay. But do you know the only person who suffers from that is you? Because it's in the darkest hour where you've put on those brave faces and you've told everybody that you're fine and you've succeeded every single day and you've accomplished your job role and you've everybody in work's happy, aren't they? Brilliant, yes, everyone in work, but you're the one that sat there at home. You're the one that's going to be sat there, not dealing with your problems. And my darkest hour, I had nobody to talk to because I hadn't nurtured that. And that was my first encounter of being at the point where I no longer wanted to be here. I wanted the voices, that, and I don't mean the voices in the crazy sense, in the sense that the negative voice, the negativity, the negative voices, they're the ones you want to stop. You want to stop looking at the outlook on life. Just because you have mental health conditions doesn't mean you're inherently crazy. We all deal with pressures every single day. Pressures that we're not even built for. We've not even evolved into the pressures that we are faced with on a daily basis as a human race. Everybody knows that. We've come on leaps and bounds in the last couple of centuries. Especially the way that we're advancing in technology, the way that we're open to everything. The pressures that we feel now are unprecedented. And this was the start. This was me years ago. I've got years to talk about this another two episodes, and the build-up to those were completely different. But that's just the importance of understanding mental health, and as difficult as that sounds, it's important to talk about. Because it can start from a niggle, it can start from a scratch. That little scratch starts consuming you. And that's the problem, is it starts off with a little bit of negativity here and a little bit of negativity there. And then, before you know it, they get embedded into your thought process on a daily basis. You start looking at life negatively. And then when you think about, when you think about work, and if you think about work negatively, and it is now affecting you, you don't want to go into work, why are we doing it? Yes, because some of us have to. But always search, always progress, always build yourself up to get out of there. Give yourself a goal. Give yourself a plan. If you're not happy, don't endure it for years. Build a plan to remove yourself away from that stress. It's so important to acknowledge that. And that's why it's so important to talk about the negative effects of mental health, and that's suicide, and that is the ultimate aspect of it. And like I said to you at the start, I'm just an average Joe Bloggs. I just go through life. I do what everybody normally does. But we need to look after ourselves in the sense that by not talking, and for those years where I just functioned, thinking that by showing everybody out in the world that I'm okay, and not going in and saying, fucking hell. I mean, you know, just reaching out to your friend and saying, fucking hell, man, I'm a bit stressed about this, and getting some advice, or that's a bit of pressure. Or instead of enduring a pressure at work, ask for some help from somebody to make your life easier. A problem shared is a problem halved. I talk about it. And that's the most important part about this, is making sure that by developing your communication skills, you start to avoid the problems. You start to address the problems before they get to that point where you're like me and you have a family around you, you have very good friends around you, you have a good career, but you still want to go. You still had enough. I still didn't want to be here. I still didn't want to look at life anymore. And there's people out there far worse off than me. But it doesn't matter who you are. Mental health does not discriminate. It doesn't matter what you identify as. It doesn't matter what gender you are. It doesn't matter what age you are. You are susceptible to the negativity or the negative aspects of mental health. You are all chances of getting a mental health problem. And that's why we don't want to get to those darkest hours. We don't want to get to the darkest hour. That's the part we're trying to avoid. It's so important to do that. We don't want you to be that statistic. We all have down days, but those down days can be stopped by talking, by nurturing, by looking after each other. They can be stopped by doing that. And it's not about showing weakness. It's not about looking like you're the weaker person. It's just about looking for advice, looking for guidance, looking for support. We've all had different paths. But here I am, just an average Joe Bloggs, susceptible by not talking. If I'd have spoken all those years ago about how I was feeling when I was negative, bearing in mind I had a car crash and I had to do the same journey to go into work every day. I had to do that to survive. And that's what built into depression. It's something as easy as a car crash that everybody is at risk of having. By not dealing with my problems and just letting them grow, that's where I got to. This isn't something that happens overnight. One day you're sad, the next day you want to give up. This is a build-up of you not dealing with your problems. And that's what we need to capture. That's the part we need to capture, is to stop us from getting to our darkest hour. Thank you very much for listening. And this is just an insight into a little series of an insight really into the end will be how far I've come along. So stick with it. You know, this is really important stuff. This is us fighting the fight, getting past this darkest hour and showing strength and unity. So thanks very much for listening. And I will speak to you again soon. Take care, everyone.